John Updike is joining us for a return visit to Fresh Air. Updike is the author of 36 books, including Rabbit Run, Becca Book, and The Witches of Eastwick. He's won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, the American Book Award, and the National Book Critics Circle Award. In spite of his achievements, Updike has tried to keep a relatively low public profile. Celebrity, he writes, even the modest sort that comes to writers, is an unhelpful exercise in self-consciousness. Celebrity is a mask that eats into the face. As soon as one is aware of being somebody to be watched and listened to with extra interest, input ceases, and the performer goes blind and deaf in his over-animation. In the past, Updike has been reticent to reveal much about his personal life to his readers, but he reflects on his life in his new memoir, Self-Consciousness. In the opening paragraph, he explains why he uncharacteristically chose himself as the subject of a book.
Shortly before the first of these personal essays was composed, but several years after the soft spring night in Shillington that it describes, I was told, perhaps in jest, of someone wanting to write my biography, to take my life, my load of ore and heap of memories, from me. The idea seemed so repulsive that I was stimulated to put down, always with some natural hesitation and distaste, these elements of an autobiography. They record what seems to me important about my own life, and try to treat this life, this massive datum which happens to be mine, as a specimen life, representative in its odd uniqueness of all the oddly unique lives in this world. A mode of impersonal egoism was my aim, an attempt to touch honestly upon the central veins with a scientific dispassion and curiosity.
Can you explain that fear of somebody taking your memories from you to write a biography?
Well, a writer's life isn't quite like a statesman's life, you know. It's what you write out of, and I just didn't want to be, and don't want to be intruded upon in that way. So as a defense against intrusion, I decided to invade my own privacy with these essays. At least I would know how to do it and would do it with good taste and delicately, and I'd know where to go. And if my life is of any intrinsic interest, and I'm not sure it is of much, I'm the one who's lived it, and the kind of things that I write about in this book are certainly things that a biographer would not fasten upon.
Are there any things that you dislike about the form of memoirs that you tried to avoid in your own?
Well, I tried to avoid a merely sequential account of events. In my case, there aren't that many events in my life. The main events, aside from the births of my children and my two marriages and the deaths of my seniors, have been the books themselves. So the biography is quite adequately stated on the back of the jacket, really, in a few words. There is no life except seen poetically, as it were, seen with a metaphysical search in mind.
Well, the poetic device you seem to use is your body. The revelations in the central part of, you know, in the middle part of your memoirs come not from your career as a writer, but from your body, from physical ailments, from psoriasis, from a stutter, from asthma.
Yes, well, they what seemed to come to my attention of those moments of discomfort. And remember, the title of the book is Self-Consciousness, so I fastened upon those things which either made me self-conscious, like the psoriasis, or which showed self-consciousness, like the stuttering. And the religious aspect of it, again, has to do with the question of a self at all. Why do we seem to have selves that we prize greatly? Do computers, with almost as much circuitry now as human brains, do computers have selves? Are computers self-conscious? Is a wasp self-conscious? I think not. It's a kind of specifically human thing, which I was interested in exploring via my own poor little set of facts.
You first got psoriasis in kindergarten in 1938. Did people in the literary world know that you had a skin problem before you wrote about it?
I don't know. I suppose some did. I wrote a kind of amusing, I've always thought, short story called Journal of a Leper, or From the Journal of a Leper, which is about psoriasis, and which is much quoted in medical texts of a certain kind. Psoriasis is rather rarely written about. We're all shy about it, those of us who have it, and wish we didn't and don't want to talk about it much. So it took a long time for me to confess to it. I feel it's some, you know, it's a sin of some kind. It's a dermal sin, and it took me a long time to believe that it wasn't really my fault, and I could talk about it more or less freely. No, I don't think it was commonly known. I'm told it doesn't really much show, and the discomfort has mostly been self-produced rather than other people produced.
Well, were you worried about calling attention to it, though?
No, not really. A writer is somebody who tries to tell the truth, right? And your value to your society is a certain willingness to risk being honest. And so to be honest about this was part of the general job as I see it.
Well, I think you found a lot of universals in the particulars of your experience with psoriasis. And I'd like to ask you to read an excerpt of your chapter on psoriasis. And my guest is John Updike, and this is a reading from his new book, Self-Consciousness.
Psoriasis keeps you thinking. Strategies of concealment ramify, and self-examination is endless. You're forced to the mirror again and again. Psoriasis compels narcissism. If we can suppose a narcissist who did not like what he saw, in certain lights, your face looks passable. In slightly different other lights, not. Shaving mirrors and rear-view mirrors in automobiles are merciless, whereas the smoky mirrors in airplane bathrooms are especially flattering and soothing. One's face looks as tawny as a movie star's. Flying back from the Caribbean, I used to admire my improved looks. Years went by before I noticed that I looked equally good in the lavatory glow on the flight down. I cannot pass a reflecting surface on the street without glancing in hopes that I have somehow changed. Nature and the self, the great moieties of earthly existence, are each cloven in two by a fascinated ambivalence. One hates one's abnormal, erupting skin, but is led into a brooding, solicitous attention toward it. One hates the nature that has imposed this affliction, but only this same nature can be appealed to for erasure, for cure. Only nature can forgive psoriasis. The sufferer, in his self-contempt, does not grant to other people this power.
There's a sentence in there that I think probably a lot of people will really see themselves in, and that is, I cannot pass reflecting surface on the street without glancing in the hopes that I have somehow changed. I really think you put your finger on something there.
Well, I'm happy to hear it, because I've always thought that nobody except me was annoyed with the way they looked or self-conscious to this degree. But I guess we all are. It's a strange thing, isn't it, to be born into a certain body instead of an ideal body. And all of our faces, the whole idea of a face is slightly funny, isn't it? If you can put yourself outside of the species a moment, that these faces we carry around with the holes in them and the shining holes and the dark holes and then the one that shows a lot of teeth, it's all odd beyond belief, really.
Yeah, well, you feel like, well, it's my face, but my face isn't my fault.
Right. It's not your fault, but it is what you're stuck with.
Well, you seem to think that it's some of your weaknesses that have made you what you are, some of your defects, like psoriasis. You think that you became the person who you are and the writer who you are because of it.
Well, I think it forced my attention away from any very public career, like being an actor or a school teacher, which is a kind of actor, and what my father did, and was that was the profession that society had more or less laid out for me. And I think my determination to avoid teaching is in part a shyness of any kind of public performance daily, putting yourself there, trying to look good. So I've been extra serious about making it as a freelance writer, where I don't really have to come out of the closet, where I can do the whole thing at a distance and in a room by myself via the mails. So yes, in that extent. Also, psoriasis has made me be a little bolder than I might have ordinarily been, and it certainly got me to the Caribbean. I've seen a lot of lovely islands that I wouldn't have seen if I didn't have psoriasis.
You said it made you bolder. You write, only psoriasis could have taken a very average little boy, a boy who loved the average, the daily, the safely hidden, and turned him into an adaptable, ruthless enough writer. Where does the ruthlessness come in?
Well, I think telling the truth is kind of a ruthless act, both in specifics, since you do invade some privacies in fiction, and in the larger way, you are trying to, or I am trying to, as it were, rub humanity's face in the facts of our existence, that there is much that is ignoble and desperate about being a human being, and my fiction is in part motivated by pointing these things out. So yes, there's something ruthless and cruel. Even to generate suspense is a bit of a tease, isn't it? So there's a kind of a sadistic element in the writer's attempt to keep the reader's interest.
You write, when the medicine wears off, the medicine for your psoriasis, when the medicine wears off, I will become hideous. I will become what I am. With a sentiment like that, I would have expected you to be writing horror movies. That's really a horror movie material.
Yeah, no Stephen King eye. I'm a mainstream writer, not a genre writer. I think there's enough horror to be detected in under the skin of the normal existence. I am interested, in a sense, in the violence within the home and betrayals of all sorts and with our cruel side. But I try to braid all this into a realistic picture of normal life. I think any genre like horror, which offers itself as an escape from reality in some way, is a step down from what I'm trying to do.
At the end of your chapter about your skin, it's pretty well cleared up because of some experimental treatments you were getting. Did you have any problems after writing about this? A lot of people believe that psoriasis has a component of psychology behind it.
It has a psychosomatic component.
Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. So I was wondering if really thinking about it a lot and writing about it made you any more symptomatic.
I didn't have a flare. We call that a flare in the trade when your psoriasis suddenly goes bad again. And I do say in the piece that it rather resists all these treatments, that when I was young, a few days in the sun would do marvels. And the older I got, the longer it took. In a way, the tougher the skin and the psoriasis became. And so would the artificial light treatment, which for 10 years gave me 10 years of feeling pretty good about myself and my skin. Now I'm on a pill. Which also has done a pretty good job. So I'm not at a very dermally stressed moment in my life, and I wasn't aware of... In a way, it's a relief to have it all out there, and I put it out not to say poor old me, but lucky me. Lucky me that I had this affliction, which made me be a little original and which forced me, as it were, into the artist's isolation, which gave me the courage to try to be an artist.
There's another thing that comes out of it, too, I think. You know, when you're reading about somebody facing problems that they've endured, you don't want to come out of it feeling sorry for them. You want to come out of it feeling kind of invigorated and that you learned something about yourself through reading about them. It's really probably very hard to write about the subjects that you're writing about in your new book without getting self-indulgent or even maudlin. I mean, you don't want your readers to feel sorry for you. And I think you've really succeeded with that. I mean, that's not the feeling you'd have at all, is feeling sorry for this guy. You feel like, wow, these are things I've really thought about.
Well, I see myself as pretty lucky, really. I was a small-town boy who wanted to be a writer, and I've become a writer. And every day I wake up kind of grateful that I've been given this opportunity. So, no, I don't feel basically sorry for myself at all. And even while writing about these adversities, I was trying to be, to an extent, funny about it.
Exactly, yeah.
And some of them are quite funny. The teeth chapter, the teeth section, for example, is some people tell me, hilarious. It was painful to suffer through, but writing is this funny kind of magic. You know, you can take a series of painful experiences, and just in writing about them, you somehow get rid of the pain.
You also devote a chapter in the memoir to the stutter that you had. And you say in it that, you know, with the stutter and the psoriasis, when people wouldn't acknowledge it, when they wouldn't mention it to you, you'd wonder, is this invisible to other people?
Well, you don't know how bad you look or sound to other people, and there's always the hope that, in fact, you look and sound fine. I have rarely... the stutter comes and goes, and when it does come, is embarrassing to me. My wife tells me it's charming, but I've never found other stuttering people especially charming, so I kind of take that with a grain of salt. But yes, I guess there is the hope that if at least it might be noticed but not written about, and it was this article written by a reporter for the Jerusalem Post that came right out and talked about my stutter. I was uneasy in that situation. I think I was tired from jet lag, and I didn't quite, I was cast into a role where I felt uneasy. And as I say in the piece, I think that's when I begin to stutter, is when I feel somehow mistaken or uneasy in the role I'm performing.
You say something that I think, again, a lot of us will have experienced, that when you take something that's supposed to be unconscious, like the act of speaking, you know, moving your tongue around to form vowels, and it suddenly becomes a conscious act, you lose yourself, you lose it. It's like when you think about walking with grace, you walk really stiffly. When you think about breathing, you become really conscious of every breath that you take, and it becomes a belabored act instead of an unconscious one.
It's quite true. And speaking, you think of the number of muscular motions that your tongue is making just to form the sentence you so gracefully uttered. It's amazing it works as well as it does.
You know, the last time we did an interview on Fresh Air, we talked a little bit about why you dislike being interviewed and about how you distrust the kind of public self that writers are sometimes forced to cultivate. In reading your memoir, I of course started to think that other reasons had to do with perhaps fear of stuttering, with fear that skin would be broken out.
Yes, both.
Okay.
Both are true, and it was a great relief when I first began to go on television years ago. I was delighted to find that you got a coat of makeup, and I always felt immensely happier once I was made up, and I would wear it all day long until it wore off, so that... Yes. On the other hand, having that anxiety about how you look or whether you're going to stutter or not relieves you of other anxieties. And the truth seems to be that I'm a fairly garrulous performer once I'm launched in that direction. It's almost a bad trait in me that should not be encouraged.
I want you to read another paragraph from your book, and this is from John Updike's new memoir, Self-Consciousness. And we were talking before about really so much of your body comes into play in this set of memoirs. And this is related to a chapter about asthma, and you associate asthma with a period when you tried to break out of your marriage and initially failed and then later actually broke out of it.
Yes, I did, and I will read the section which, under the heading of trying to tell the truth. I go from stuttering in this chapter to breathing, and I think there's some swallowing in there.
Choking,
too.
Yeah.
Choking, which I did used to do. There's a kind of a claustrophobia, something very curious to me about the throat as the passageway whereby the heart and the head communicate. Anyway, I'm more conscious of that narrow passageway. And this is about asthma and my domestic feelings at the time, my life situation. A door had opened and shut. My timidity and conscience had slammed it shut. My wife and children were my captors, but I could not blame them. They had done nothing after all but come when I called. When young, I had wanted a wife who would be attractive and motherly and artistic and quiet, and she materialized. We wanted children, and they obediently came, healthy and lovable, and two of each sex. Now, through no fault of their own, they composed a household whose walls seemed to be shrinking around me, squeezing my chest. No first attack stands in my memory. The squeezing, the panic crept in, and were suddenly there, like my Barth reading and my poetry writing, for I was never more of a poet than in this angst-besmogged period. The breathlessness would tend to come on in the evening. We didn't know what it was, pure inner demons, or an ingenious psychosomatic mechanism to make my wife feel guilty about being still married to me, or what.
You know, reading that paragraph, I couldn't help but think about the claustrophobia that Rabbit feels in your novel when he leaves.
Yes, I think he very much was an early projection of this sense of claustrophobia, of domestic claustrophobia, which we shouldn't blame entirely, shouldn't blame at all, in fact, upon the, or blame much upon the first wife. I think there is a sort of a general human, or male human at least, feeling of any settled situation has become something of an entrapment. There's always the American notion of the territory west, that there is a kind of realm of freedom out there which beckons. And one way of expressing one's claustrophobia is, I suppose, to have trouble breathing.
This is the first time you've written that I know of directly about your family, and you don't write that much about your family in your memoir. But I guess I was wondering what, if your family was ever offended by things that you'd said about families in fiction, in your novels, that they assumed to be about themselves.
I've been surrounded by very kind and good families, beginning with my parents. My mother, after all, thought it would be a good thing to become a writer, so she's taken her medicine as I've written with good grace. And my father was an immensely encouraging and forbearing man. And my first wife and my second wife could both be described as very kind women who see, of course, that writing is what I do. Every profession has its handicaps, and a certain amount of telling is a risk you run if you get mixed up with a writer. And my children didn't ask for this. They were just born. And for the 15 years when I wrote mostly about families, they weren't reading me, and I was grateful for that. But certainly I said nothing about them that they couldn't read. And fiction is, let's not forget, fiction. A writer who undertakes to tell a story is under no obligation to real people, really. Your obligation is to the reader and to create something that makes sense as a work of fiction.
There's one last reading that I want to get in. And this is from a section toward the end of your memoir. And it's really about, it's in part about the fears that that one experiences at night, and you writing about them during the day.
Yeah, and it's about writing as a release, isn't it? As a kind of self-therapy. I do think that writers who have any kind of social sanction for their activity are one up, because when you write about something in a strange way, you become lightened of it. Let me read this paragraph. So, writing is my sole remaining vice. It is an addiction, an illusory release, a presumptuous taming of reality, a way of expressing lightly the unbearable. That we age and leave behind this litter of dead, unrecoverable selves is both unbearable and the commonest thing in the world. It happens to everybody. In the morning light, one can write breezily, without the slightest acceleration of one's pulse, about what one cannot contemplate in the dark without turning in panic to God. In the dark, one truly feels that immense sliding, that turning of the vast earth into darkness and eternal cold, taking with it all the furniture and scenery and the bright distractions and warm touches of our lives. Even the barest earthly facts are unbearably heavy, weighted as they are with our personal death. Writing, in making the world light, in codifying, distorting, prettifying, verbalizing it, approaches blasphemy.
Do you feel ever that it's your demons that keep you writing? Even though you'd like to talk of yourself about writing, about average things, about the little corners, about the domestic news.
I think there's something demonic in the complete writer. Yes, I think that an ideally nice person would probably not become a writer. I try to write pleasantly, fairly more than pleasantly. I feel there is much in life that is frightening and unpleasant, and that we are, among other things, cruel beings, and all of the shadow side of one's self-knowledge, of course, goes into writing, and in a way energizes it. It gives you the energy to undertake this fantastic activity every morning.
Your memoir begins with you in the neighborhood that you grew up in, walking the streets, going back to the house you grew up in, and thinking about what life was like there. And you say, I wanted to feel something, but felt less than I had hoped. What kind of feelings did you experience in reviewing your life to write this memoir? Did you also feel yourself feeling less than you'd hoped?
No, I felt quite a lot writing it, and I tried to really write only about those areas that in some way were painful and would really quicken me into good memory. Nostalgia can't be endlessly renewed about the same thing. As Proust in The Masterpiece of Nostalgia points out, it must spring upon us unawares. So when I looked at my old house, I'd perhaps done that too often before to really feel the deep pang of nostalgia. But other parts of that same walk had moved me greatly. The same thing, a sudden, unexpected revival of a life that was dead, of a self that was gone.
I think that you've just completed a really, an interesting exercise in the sense, you know, in your book, in the sense that you've taken things that had been private and made them public. And I'd like to know what that feels like to, you know, we all have things in our lives that we think, well, if people knew about this, they'd like me less. Maybe they'd even put my work into some kind of different light. They'd question my motivations for things. And you've taken some of those things and made them public. You know, what's it like?
Well, better me than another, I figured. And I do have the writer's control over what I choose to divulge. And my self-knowledge is imperfect. And, of course, there's a lot I left out. But in a funny way, this book, now that it's completed, becomes just one more book. And I feel oddly detached from the John Updike who it's about. I mean, I feel almost like he's a character in fiction and I'm walking away from him. So I don't feel utterly involved, even in this rather confessional self-exploratory work.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you so much for your time and for doing the readings and for talking with us about your book. Thank you.
Thank you.